Last night at the Passover Seder held here, the quote by Rabbi Arthur Waskow that greeted us on the front page of the program booklet, or Haggadah, was this. In every generation, Pharaoh. In every generation, freedom. If you don't know the story of Pesach, or the festival of Passover, you got a small taste of it from the dramatic reenactment offered by the Riggers family. And if you're hungry for more, mark your calendars now for the Fellowship's Passover Seder in April 2019. Each year, at the traditional ceremony and meal, Jews and others who celebrate commemorate this important legacy of enslavement, exodus, and freedom. Part of the ritual is to name that historically people have been enslaved, and that today some are still in captivity. Harbor House is the recipient of our offering today because addressing domestic violence in our families and our community is one way we champion freedom and liberation. I am not enslaved by an actual pharaoh, which is a Greek word based on an Egyptian word for great house that has come to mean the ruler of ancient Egypt. Especially compared with the hardships of many, I am free in literal and meaningful ways. It is only right to own my privilege. But that does not mean I am never confined in certain ways, that I never feel trapped, or that I never struggle to free myself from an idea or habit that binds me, although I do not wish to serve it. In these ways, I do encounter Pharaoh. One of the pharaohs I try to get free from is perfectionism. One of the blessings and curses of my life is that almost everything I do, personally and professionally, matters a lot. I get to be involved in important work, another privilege that is not universal, but should be. People depend on me. I care about being a kind and loving friend, wife, mother, daughter, sister, minister, citizen, and human. I strive to be good at my job and to my family. All of that is in the blessing column. The challenge is that when I fall short or mess up, then that also matters. It impacts those I have unintentionally failed. And also devastate me. I realized a new layer of this when I mishandled something in my home life a few weeks ago. In the grand scheme of things, this event was minor. I could have stood up for someone in my family more firmly, but I was caught off guard by an unexpected situation, and I just didn't. I felt guilty for my failure. I was upset. When my partner Amy mentioned this incident to my parents, and they rushed in to sympathize with me and offer support, I started sobbing so hard I couldn't even explain what happened or how I was feeling, leaving them convinced that something major had gone awry, a problem much worse than a verbal confrontation with someone unpleasant who doesn't impact my life in any lasting way. Before I had my parents' concern to compare my overreaction against, I was not aware that I was being harder on myself than was reasonable, even though Amy had tried to tell me. I'm a fairly emotionally healthy person, but I do fight perfectionism, sparring even with the idea of it, Years ago, when first presented with the inkling that I might have these tendencies, I inquired indignantly, "What is so wrong with high standards?" Well, I have since learned that perfectionism isn't about rising above low standards. It's something entirely different. It's about refusing to accept any standard short of a mythical ideal. My breakthrough in the struggle against my perfectionism, Pharaoh, is the realization that perfect is a lie. At the Passover, we tell the story of a journey toward freedom. It takes into account that even the best-intentioned humans are flawed, reminding us that moral or spiritual perfection has never been attained. In the Exodus narrative, even God doesn't always behave kindly or confidently. Modern Unitarian Universalist theology also argues against the perfect. We emphasize growth, learning, and being rooted in human relationship. None of that is ultimately compatible with perfection. Psychology, likewise, has reached overwhelming consensus that quality of life is higher for those who aim for excellence but do not demand perfection of themselves or others. Dee shared with us about one of her pharaohs, procrastination, which is often perfectionism's offspring. Both are toxic mindsets, rendering us so desperate to avoid failure that they can con us into hyper-focusing on the small at the expense of the possible. Perfectionism breeds procrastination. It binds us to a fear of failure so securely that even trying becomes unwise and impossible. Understanding the extremity to which this can degenerate keeps me resolved to fight my pharaoh of perfection. About a year and a half ago, I accidentally stumbled across a secret weapon of liberation. I signed up for a pottery class for literally no reason other than that I was weary and it seemed fun. Here are some of my babies. That's my cat. Sharing studio space with actual professional artists frees me to be an amateur. I am there simply to experience, experiment, and enjoy. Time spent there is elevated from hobby to spiritual practice because I literally cannot fail. I have no production quota. There is no demanding instructor who might refuse me course credit. The worst that can happen is I shape something ugly and have the satisfaction of smashing the damp clay in on itself, readying it to be recycled and reformed into something else some other day. Do you see this piece? I made it on Tuesday. It hasn't been fired, glazed, or fired again. Can you see that straight edge at the top of the middle seam? While the rest of the vase's lines are less precise and rougher. So does that contrast look cool and interesting, or sort of stupid and jarring? Don't answer that. Because I don't know yet. We'll see. The consequences for it turning out badly are pretty low. No one will be harmed if it ends up in my basement with its reject pottery friends. Yet there are consequences for not giving it a try. The way I smushed the bottom of the vase, that's a technical art term that I just made up, by the way, smushed. That's something that I'll definitely do again. What if I had been too afraid to fail and I didn't play around with getting my thumb to squish the wet clay in that upward motion? I don't expect the technique to land me in a museum. That's not why I'm talking about it here. But it could look just right on a different piece. Also, it was fun. I have a busy life, high stress at times, and fun matters. It's how I'm learning to release the pressure that can add up to the feeling that I need to do it all right, or else I will be a complete failure. That's how I resist my Pharaoh. Here are two vases that I made last month just for the heck of it. Taking one measly pottery class has emboldened me as I prepare for my upcoming sabbatical. In Unitarian Universalism and at the fellowship, clergy are eligible for a month of sabbatical for every year they have served. Best practices encourage a sabbatical every 4 years, but due to our senior ministry transition, that just wasn't feasible for me and for us. And so this summer, as I begin my 7th year of ministry here, I will head off on a 6-month sabbatical. I know. Let me tell you a little about how it will work and why sabbatical is important for clergy and congregations. Your executive team, me, Reverend Christina, and our business administrator, Phyllis Schmidt, worked with our staff to figure out how a sabbatical could fit into all the priorities and projects around here. And then your governing board voted to approve our proposal. On July 1st, after I head out, the Reverend Jim Coakley, a fellowship member who followed the call to ministry and now serves local UU fellowships, will begin a part-time temporary position here as the assistant sabbatical minister. He will be available mainly for pastoral care, since that's the biggest part of fellowship life that I am the only staff person to handle. You will hear more logistical details as the time nears, but I want to start talking about it now, because sabbatical is a unique opportunity for congregation and minister. The minister gets to set aside time from the hustle and bustle of what is, in reality, a 6 to 7 days a week job for some study, reflection, rest, and renewal. The congregation and the minister benefit from renewed energy once the sabbatical ends. During my sabbatical, you all will get to experience this shared ministry differently, and in some ways without me, maybe more fully. Congregations generally report that clergy sabbaticals help lay leaders sharpen their leadership skills, decrease dependence on the minister who is away, and connect more intimately with the minister who is still around. I hope and expect that this will be true for me and for you. The only sabbaticals in the fellowship's history, both taken by the Reverend Roger Birchhausen in 1996 and 2013, were different in that he left the state and then the continent. I will primarily be staying in Appleton during my sabbatical. I love living a life that is entwined with the fellowship, and I fully expect I will continue to see many of you at the park, coffee shop, exercise class, community event. Please know that I will not be available to discuss anything related to the fellowship. I won't be doing ministry with you for 6 whole months. But please do feel invited to stop and say hello, just as you might if we see each other at the grocery store tomorrow. While I am excited to have Sunday morning flexibility, and I actually look forward to maybe attending a few other local congregation services, I will pop in here from time to time, simply to worship with my family. Stability is particularly important for my kids, and they like it here. Frankly, they get mad if I'm guest preaching elsewhere. There's no way they would agree to stay away for 6 months. When we swing by here on occasion, we will attend the service and slip away discreetly. But I want you to know this might happen so you aren't confused. While I'm away, there are 2 projects in particular that I look forward to tackling. The first is to conduct some interviews with Unitarian Universalist congregations larger than the fellowship about how they offer pastoral care. How do congregations with 1, 4, or 800 more members balance the ways that folks want to be known and cared for, but also feel their privacy is respected? How do they use pastoral care committees, letter writing teams, friendly visiting programs, and more? What staffing structures are required to realistically support these efforts? What can I learn and bring back to the fellowship as it grows? My other goal, likely not a surprise, is that I am going to do pottery. I am going to give myself permission to get to know me in a wholly new way, as a creative person who encounters the sacred and her own imperfections by daring to make art. This is new and scary territory for me. I'm going to try to remember that the art I make might not be good, but that my goal isn't to make the perfect vase, the ideal tray, or the technically skilled bowl. It's just to do it for the sake of doing it. And bowls are weirdly hard, by the way. I am grateful to have this sabbatical. I don't take it for granted. Everyone should have their own version of regular rest and renewal. Almost everyone I know works hard in some way. Since I have this incredible freedom, I am going to make use of it. My commitment to myself is that I will follow where it leads me without overthinking or trying to do it all perfectly. My commitment to you is that I will come back rested with a renewed sense of spaciousness and freedom, which I will offer to my ministry with you here. So we have completed a circle. Our journey ends where we began. We're back at freedom. We're back to facing that which we need to challenge in order to secure our liberation, whether it is literal enslavement or a toxic attitude, like perfectionism is for me. Each of us encounters a pharaoh or two in life, but we can learn from Pesach, from the festival of the Passover, that fighting for our freedom is worthy, messy, creative, and imperfect work. It wouldn't be freedom if it looked any other way. Remember, in every generation, Pharaoh. In every generation, freedom.